The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Alongside that, you get a £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. It is 2025 and Donald Trump is president once again of the United States. We will, of course, be following the moves of the Donald and his second administration very closely. However, it won't just be politics for us this year. We'll also talk a lot and cover American culture, life, and the arts. I should also remind you, because my producer Natasha will not let me hear the end of it, that we are on Spectator TV. So head to our YouTube channel to watch that. I'm delighted to be joined today by Edward Luce, who is the Financial Times' chief US columnist, and he is also the author of a new large book. It's big. It's big enough. It's The Life of Zbigniew Brzezinski, America's Cold War Prophet, and it's absolutely fascinating. I've just finished it this morning. Edward, first of all, congratulations on writing this very large and broad book that follows the career of somebody perhaps Americano listeners aren't too familiar with, but he is a very important figure in the America of the Cold War. Can you explain why you were drawn to write this biography and why Zbig matters so much to you?
Well, first of all, thanks very much for having me on and for reading the book. Brzezinski was Henry Kissinger's great rival, didn't match him in terms of celebrity. I'm not sure any sort of modern diplomat or geopolitical strategist could possibly match Henry Kissinger's celebrity. I remember as a child him being mentioned a couple of times on Fawlty Towers. I can't imagine Brzezinski being mentioned on Fawlty Towers. But Brzezinski, I think, and I try to set out in the book, had a larger impact than Henry Kissinger on the Cold War and hasn't received his due. Unlike Kissinger, didn't cooperate with biographers. There were books on him, but he didn't make available all the private papers and diaries he kept when he was in office. And after he died, his family came to me without strings attached with those diaries. And once I started reading them, these were a sort of gripping first draft of history. And I got hooked. I think it's a sort of huge gap in the market that there isn't really a big biography of Brzezinski. And hopefully I've filled that, at least for the time being.
Well, I think you have. And I think in the book, you point out that Kissinger and Zbig were both, I'm going to call him Zbig because I always mispronounce Brzezinski. Kissinger and Zbig were both scholar politicians, really. They were political figures who were immensely well-read and spent a lot of their time dealing with, talking to, being part of academia.
Yeah, they were both products of what was called the Cold War University, this sort of Harvard, Columbia, many of the other Ivy Leagues had a rapid turnaround after the Second World War when we were moving into the Cold War. America realized it was flying blind to some degree. Very little scholarly knowledge of the Soviet Union, of Russia, very little study of that. And it went from a very sort of flimsy academic firepower to enormous firepower. And Kissinger and Brzezinski, both immigrants, both in fact pitched up on America's shores in 1938, just before and just after the Munich Agreement, as children. Mm. So just crossing the Atlantic in time. Both of them, of course, brought with them the languages that they spoke, the knowledge of the bloodlands of Central Europe. Kissinger from Germany and Bavaria, and Brzezinski from Poland. And their skills as a scholar, their talents as scholars, rocketed them up to become luminaries, really, of Harvard in the 1950s, then Columbia in New York, in Brzezinski's case in the 60s. as a Sovietologist. Kissinger was a diplomatic historian.
Mm.
Brzezinski was a Sovietologist. And this was a new field. And he rocketed pretty much to the sort of top handful of figures pretty quickly, but was ambitious to move beyond scholarship. And that he and Kissinger did. And their legendary rivalry really began when Nixon picked Kissinger as his national security advisor, to the surprise of many people, including his sparring partner Brzezinski in 1968, after he won that presidential election.
And Brzezinski was Polish, as you say, and a lot of the critics of Brzezinski would say that his Polishness was his primary motivation. He was more Polish than he was American. But you don't think that's the case?
I think the Polishness was a very, very important part of his biography. And, you know, any biography, it's important that the formative years are really sort of understood well by the biographer. And his first decade was spent in Europe. His dad was a Polish diplomat. And so, in fact, he wasn't in Poland for all of that. He was in Leipzig. He was in France, in Lyon, where his dad was consul general. And then only for a handful of years was he in Warsaw, but he was raised a Pole, and he had, particularly that period of history, what Poles always have, which is a burning sense of amputated history.
Mm.
This was the sort of interbellum period where Poland briefly had a republic that had been created by the Treaty of Versailles, by Woodrow Wilson's list of points after the First World War. And that, of course, ended a year after Brzezinski crossed the Atlantic with the Nazi-Soviet pact, the invasion from both sides of Poland. So he had a strong sense of wounded Polishness. I describe as a sort of motivating rocket boost in his life. But he became American and never lost his accent, like Kissinger. Neither of them lost their accents, but when he first went back to Poland as a scholar in 1957, so he'd been away almost 20 years, that's when he realized he was American. He saw the sort of lifelessness, the dead eyes of so many Poles under the communist regime there, and realized actually he was American.
Mm. And he obviously had that, at Leipzig, he had this experience of Nazism and obviously Poland's terrible experience at the hands of Nazism. But it really did seem to be Russia that became, or the Soviet Union that became, the focus of his life. He had an overwhelming ambition to thwart the Soviet Union.
Yes. I mean, there is a Polish joke that, you know, if you're invaded by Germany and Russia, who do you fight first? And they say, Germany first, Russian second, business before pleasure. You know, there is a centuries-long Polish resentment of Russia, the Tsarist Russia occupied Poland for a long time. And the Cold War, of course, was against Russia, but being dressed up as the Soviet Union. But he saw it essentially as a Russian empire in Marxist clothes and believed that the Soviet bloc was not a monolith. That was very much the assumption of people in the early parts of the Cold War. He saw it as actually an empire in which there were many suppressed nations, not just in the Warsaw Pact, behind the Iron Curtain of places like Poland and Hungary and Czechoslovakia, but also within the USSR itself, the Kazakhs, the Tajiks, the Armenians, the Georgians, the Ukrainians.
Mm.
And he saw those suppressed nationalisms as the Soviet Union's Achilles heel. And that really was the key to the Cold War strategy he took to Washington and into power. Kissinger's was very different. He saw the USSR as a sort of permanent feature of the landscape, if you like, and something with a power, a superpower with which we in the West had to learn how to live, because it would be around for a long time.
Mm. And Brzezinski's real taste of power was under Carter. He was national security advisor under Carter. And there was a Playboy article that you mentioned that called him the real president. And he was obviously very preoccupied with the Cold War and the Soviet Union, but Carter got very bogged down in the Middle East. How did Brzezinski juggle all that, and how successful was he as a national security advisor?
Well, it was a legendary sort of battle within the Carter administration between Brzezinski, you know, who was running things for Carter from the White House as his national security advisor, and Cyrus Vance, who was Carter's Secretary of State, and very much more on the sort of WASP, wise man, sort of grandee sort of side of American foreign policy. And so temperamentally, they were very different, because Brzezinski was, you know, he liked knockdown fights. He was a pugilist. Mm. And he'd encountered quite a lot of suspicion that his Polishness was an inherent bias, and he would get America into a war with the Russians for ancient Polish reasons. And he had to sort of deal with that from the big grandees like Averell Harriman, that what in any other context we might call the English Americans. Mm. But for America's sort of origin, that hyphenation was never used. But the Anglophilic elites did not like him. And Vance was really the last of the great WASPs to hold office. And so they had a running feud. The way I see it is that Vance had Carter's heart. Vance wanted to sustain detente, relaxation with the Soviets. He wanted at all costs another nuclear arms limitation agreement, SALT II, the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, SALT I having been negotiated by Kissinger during the Nixon years that preceded Carter. Brzezinski saw SALT II as a nice thing to have, but the most important thing he believed was to take the ideological fight back to the Soviets. Mm. Successive American administrations had really been dragged down by the albatross of Vietnam. Carter was the first president in basically more than 20 years not to have Vietnam dragging him down. Vietnam, I think Brzezinski described as the Waterloo of the WASP elites. Mm. And over time, it turned out that in this battle between Carter's head and his heart, Brzezinski began to win more and more of the big fights because of the actions of the Soviet Union. So in a way, his biggest ally was Leonid Brezhnev, the Soviet leader, whose adventurism in the Horn of Africa, in Central America, and ultimately, of course, with the invasion of Afghanistan, really destroyed any remaining sort of case for detente. And killed SALT II, by the way, in Washington. So Brzezinski sort of prevailed. He was a much sharper elbowed figure. And he laid the predicates with nuclear modernization, with restoring all the defense budget cuts, with weaponizing human rights behind the Iron Curtain, taking the ideological fight to the Soviets. He laid the predicates for Reaganism. And Ronald Reagan, you know, of course, defeated Carter. He even wanted to retain Brzezinski as his own national security advisor, which would have been unique, I think, highly, highly unusual. Mm. It didn't happen. But clearly by the end of Carter, Brzezinski's sort of vision was the one that had prevailed. And it's a really, really important piece of how we understand the Cold War.
Yes. Well, on the sort of knife fights with Vance that you described so well in your book, I couldn't help thinking that it's extraordinary that Marco Rubio is now Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. So it's a rather different scenario these days, even if we are close to a Cold War with China.
I should say, no, it's a very good point, Freddie. I mean, I should say that he's the only person to have held both jobs since Henry Kissinger.
Yes.
And Kissinger was the only one. And Kissinger made the joke that the only time the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, got along was when he had both jobs. So we can only hope Marco Rubio is getting along with himself.
Getting along with himself, yes. And then, as you mentioned in your last answer, you would give him quite a lot of credit for the success. You would give Zbig quite a lot of credit for the success that Reagan had in ending the Cold War, because I'm not sure I've read a lot of other books that have sought to do that. And to actually credit Carter for the steelier side of Carter's foreign policy that Brzezinski was behind. He was the, as you put it, one of your chapter titles is, he was the hawk in a dovish administration.
He was. And the, you know, really the key turning point, it had been building up that way, was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And there's a lot of controversy and debate about the degree to which Brzezinski, in Machiavellian style, lured the Soviets into invading Afghanistan by stoking their paranoia about the soft underbelly of the Soviet Union being exposed to American influence. And Brezhnev, by this stage, elderly, aging Soviet leader, was semi-comatose. He was drunk half the time. He was very sick, being treated for various ailments, and prone to more and more paranoia. And, you know, Brzezinski really did help stoke that paranoia and deliver, with the Soviet invasion, what he described as their Vietnam, their quagmire. Mm. Now, I think the Soviets would probably have invaded anyway. So, you know, one can overstate Machiavellianism here, but Brzezinski wanted to defeat the Soviet Union. He didn't want to live with it. Mm. And I mean, that was a very, very fundamental split. And that's why Reagan liked him so much. Mm. He was sort of Reagan's kind of, you know, Reagan was famously said, my Cold War strategy is we win, you lose. And that was a sort of short elevator version of Brzezinski's. And indeed, that's what happened. Afghanistan became very controversial. The support for the Mujahideen only later, particularly after 9/11. But at the time, you know, his funding of the Mujahideen, you know, really did bleed the Soviets dry.
Mm. Well, he did get, as you mentioned in the book, he got criticized after 9/11 for being the sort of the architect of Al-Qaeda and so on. It didn't seem to bother him that too much, though, that accusation.
It didn't bother him that much. I mean, he was, I think, dubbed by somebody as the father of Al-Qaeda. It's a little bit of a stretch. I mean, because Al-Qaeda was only created in 1987. Mm. And, you know, Carter had left office in 1981. But for sure, you know, if you look at the rhetoric that Carter and Brzezinski used to stir up the Islamic world to help support these Mujahideen groups, they spoke of God. They spoke of the common fight against the atheist Soviet Union. And it does make you, some of it makes you wince a little bit with hindsight. And some people winced at the time. Mm. But in terms of sort of sheer chessboard pragmatism, I think Brzezinski was pretty unfazed by the criticisms because he said, look, terrorism is, you know, a whole different problem, but nothing like the scale of the threat posed by the Soviets. And so I think he saw the pragmatism there is entirely justified. But yeah, there are some sort of cringeworthy moments where he's, you know, he's standing there in the sort of hilltops in the Afghan refugee camps in Pakistan, mm. waving a Kalashnikov across, you know, across the border in the Khyber Pass. And exhorting Muslims to rise up for God. It doesn't sound brilliant in retrospect.
But if he was a hawkish figure in a dovish administration under Carter, in the war on terror years, he was a voice for the doves, an intelligent voice for the doves. And Barack Obama thought he was quite an important figure too, did he not?
He did. I mean, Brzezinski came out very early against the invasion of Iraq. Obama, of course, nobody had heard of when he condemned the invasion of Iraq. Later on, you know, he used that to good effect for his campaign against Hillary Clinton. But Hillary Clinton in 07, when that sort of famous primary was starting, which I covered, in fact, for the FT, she quite successfully started pinning the charge on Obama that this guy is completely inexperienced. And who would trust him at 3 a.m. to take that phone call, that national security phone call about some imminent threat to America? And so he was beginning to flounder. I remember this very well. He was really sagging after the initial. And then Brzezinski announced that he wanted to endorse him. Mm. And given Brzezinski's former record and reputation as a hawk, somebody really hated by the left, by the way, known as Darth Vader on the campuses in the 80s, in the 70s and the 80s. The fact that Brzezinski would endorse Obama was a sort of punch the air moment for the Obama campaign. They were absolutely delighted because it really neutralized the Hillary Clinton attack. So he went from being a sort of bugbear of the left to being the darling of the left. I don't think either were sort of particularly merited. He was his own, he wasn't a tribal type.
But he was accused of anti-Semitism, for he supported John Mearsheimer and Stephen Wolfsburg, the Israel lobby. And he certainly seemed to be, he's often tarred with the accusation of anti-Semitism, possibly because he's Polish and originally a Catholic.
Yeah, that did recur. I mean, it started in early in the Carter administration when Carter was pushing for an Arab Israeli settlement. I mean, initially through what was the first normalization in the Middle East, through Egypt's recognition of Israel's right to exist. And this, you know, caused some consternation. Carter used terms like a Palestinian homeland that hadn't been at all surfacing until Carter came to office. And the pro-Israeli American groups, including AIPAC, which we now sort of see as this hugely powerful lobby group, but was then in its infancy, chose to target Brzezinski. They wanted to undermine this effort. And Brzezinski, it's, you know, far more sensible to aim at, you know, one of the king's advisors and not at the king, because you want to continue to do business with the king. So Brzezinski was the target. He sounded Polish. He was from Poland originally. And he was quite blunt in how he spoke and how he voiced his criticisms of Israel. So he did become this target, and the allegations of anti-Semitism did occur. I should mention one extraordinary thing, though. Menachem Begin, Israel's first Likud prime minister, who got elected shortly after Carter did, it's a big sea change in Israeli politics. When he came first to Washington mid-1977, he invited Brzezinski to Blair House, which is the guest house opposite the White House foreign leaders often stay in. He invited him there, but he invited all the cameras and photographers too, and the media, because he wanted them to record him giving Brzezinski an award for what his father, Tadeusz Brzezinski, Polish diplomat, had done in Leipzig in the early Nazi period, which was to hand out hundreds of passports, Polish passports, and laissez-passer to German Jews of Polish origin, and to such an extent that the Nazis asked Warsaw to recall him, which they did. Mm. And so this was a sort of a very, very warm gesture by Begin that helped, you know, that helped Brzezinski, who was quite embattled at the time. And then in the sort of legendary and marathon Camp David peace talks the following year that did produce this famous agreement, the Begin whisperer was Brzezinski. He and Begin, of course, spoke Polish to each other. Begin's origins were Polish too. So I don't think there's any sort of truth to the allegations of anti-Semitism, but he could certainly be accused of serial tactlessness in how he spoke about Israel.
Yes. The accusation of arrogance comes up quite a lot, doesn't it?
I think he would be sort of found guilty unanimously by the jury on that without it having to retire. He was an extremely ebullient, pugnacious figure. His arrogance was sort of born of, I mean, he was an extremely gifted scholar. It's quite remarkable going through his academic transcripts all the way through. He just keeps coming first in every class.
It's probably testament to how well you've written the book, but it's hard to get a real sense of whether you like him.
So I got to know him reasonably well in his last decade of life. He died in May 2017, a few months after Trump was first inaugurated. And I'd moved here to Washington, D.C. in 2006. So I used to see him for lunch from time to time. I didn't know I was going to write his biography while he was alive. But I did grow to like him. I mean, an extremely incisive brain. Really, after he died, there was nobody who quite matched him as somebody you could call as a journalist, an inquiring journalist, just to help explain the geopolitics of some story you were doing. There was nobody quite at that level. So I did end up liking him, but he wasn't easy to like. His exterior was ornery I think is fair to say.
Yeah, yeah. And lastly, I want to ask you about Ukraine, because obviously that's a very salient subject at the moment. And Brzezinski wrote this book that's quite well known in some circles called The Grand Chessboard, in which he, you know, talking of him as a prophet, he said Ukraine would be the key piece of that decides the future of Eastern Europe. And it's thought that the sort of Brzezinski doctrine did in sort of inform State Department thinking about Ukraine in the last couple of decades. To what extent did Brzezinski's thinking on Ukraine influence the State Department, influence American foreign policy?
He really pushed the Clinton administration and Clinton himself to always bring in Ukraine. At the time in the 90s, the idea was that Russia could just collapse, that it was teetering. And so there was an enormous effort to keep Boris Yeltsin propped up, another slightly inebriated Russian leader, at the expense of Ukraine. And Brzezinski really brought Ukraine to the front. Just remember that it's a pretty sort of deep Polish feeling that their fate is linked to Ukraine's. Mm. And in this book, quite famous book, Grand Chessboard, Brzezinski says that with Ukraine, Russia is a Eurasian empire. Without Ukraine, it can't be. And I think there was sort of a lot of deep Polish sensibility in that observation, but it's a pretty justifiable geopolitical observation. He was also very much at the forefront of pushing for that first expansion of NATO, had big arguments with George Kennan, you know, the original sort of former of the Doctrine of Containment. And if Poland, the Czechoslovakia and Hungary, sure enough, became the first new NATO members in 1999. This was a key Brzezinski project, still controversial, of course. But Ukraine was always in his mind linked with Poland's fate too.
And was his ambition then for Ukraine to be more of a part of Western influence, or would he have accepted some sort of neutrality for it? Because Poles seem to be quite divided on that.
Yeah, they do. Interestingly, and to some people's surprise, in 2014, Brzezinski wrote an op-ed for the Financial Times calling for the Finlandization of Ukraine. He wrote this after Putin had annexed Crimea. And this really surprised people. But I think he saw a NATO membership of Ukraine as too provocative at that point. Kissinger and he swapped roles towards the end of Kissinger's life. This is after the invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Kissinger endorsed Ukraine's membership of NATO. So they kind of swapped positions, again, to people's surprise. Kissinger gave me a lot of interviews for this book, and he saw Brzezinski, you know, not just as his great rival and frenemy, but as his only real sort of equal, as a sparring partner. And he broke down and said he was bereft when Brzezinski died, said he felt the world was a much lonelier place because he couldn't continue the argument that he had been having with Brzezinski for close to 70 years at that point. This is an extremely cinematic rivalry, the Kissinger-Brzezinski one.
It would make a good film.
Yes. I'll get Netflix to buy the rights. Get Netflix within a couple of months.
You must. Well, Edward, thank you very much and congratulations on the book. It's an extremely impressive piece of work, and all the best with it.
You're very kind. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks, Edward. Thank you for listening to that episode of Americano. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave a review on whatever platform you are watching or listening into it on. We prefer positive reviews, although some constructive criticism is also welcome. I'd also urge you to sign up to the Americano newsletter, which I write every week. It comes out on Thursdays, and people seem to be enjoying it so far. Thank you very much to the audience. Thanks also to my producer, Natasha Feroz, for doing such a wonderful job. And speak to you next time.